The Guardian.
Nova is America's most watched science series. You'll find it every night at 7:50 on PBS, Sky Channel 166, Virgin Media 243. PBS, where television matters.
Hello, I'm Jonathan Friedland, and this is a special edition of Politics Weekly.
What is on offer isn't in Britain's interests, so I didn't agree to it.
European leaders wanted an all-encompassing deal to save the euro, bind its nations closer together, and to further regulate financial markets. But Britain has said no. So now what? What does it mean for Europe's future and for Britain's place in it? What does it mean for the coalition? And can the continent's economy cope with much more uncertainty? Joining me, I have a stellar panel here in the studio with me, our financial editor, Nils Prattley. On the line, Guardian columnist Martin Kettle. And on the line from Brussels with, next to no sleep, our chief political correspondent, Nick Watt. Welcome to you all. Now, it's very common for journalists to say that an event is historic. Often that's an exaggeration with a bit of hyperbole thrown in. But let's go round to each of you. How significant is this moment? And we'll begin with you, Martin Kettle.
It feels very big, Johnny. I think it's very big for Britain. I think it's potentially very big for the European Union project. But in the end, whether it really is a historic event will depend very much on whether what has been agreed in Brussels works. And we don't know that yet. So I think that we need to stand back a little bit and see how things pan out. But it's very big on those other two points which I just made.
Nils, how significant?
For the markets, it's a big deal, but probably not as big as it should have been. As we speak at midday on Friday, the yield on Italian and Spanish bonds has gone up. Their borrowing costs have gone up, which is probably not what the leaders wanted at all. And I think the market will be looking at sort of three areas where it's disappointed. I think the European Central Bank remains with its muzzled mandate in terms of buying bonds. The much talked about bazooka is probably not going to be a very impressive weapon. There's about 500 billion euros being put up by the euro members, and there'll be another 200 billion, we found out last night, will go out of Europe to the IMF, then come back to Europe. That's probably not enough to intimidate the markets. And all the while, there are still questions about where's the growth going to come from, because it's one thing to enforce fiscal discipline on member states. It's quite another to generate growth. And the danger is that the continent slips back into recession and the debt mountain gets higher.
So a rather cautious verdict on its significance, at least financially and particularly for the euro, from you. And Nick, what you're the man there in Brussels watching this thing happen as it unfolded hour by hour. How significant does it seem from your vantage point?
It is an absolutely huge moment for Britain. I mean, after we finally made our way into what was then the EEC in 1973, after initially turning our noses up at this organisation, the British view was always that you've got to be at the top table. You've got to be, as John Major says, at the heart of Europe. When he famously negotiated those opt-outs from the single currency in the Maastricht Treaty, we did actually sign that treaty. So the view was you've always got to be in the room, always being influential. What this marks today is Britain, if perhaps not taking itself out of the room, then putting itself into a bit of a corner in the room where it will not be there shaping the key elements of the European Union in the future, because clearly the Eurogroup and the wannabe members of the Eurogroup are now at the heart of the future of this. So a big moment for Britain, but also a very big moment for France. The French dream has always been that you would have a two-speed Europe in which France and Germany would be in the fast lane and Britain would be in the slow lane. They have got that. Famously, Britain said game, set and match after the Maastricht Treaty. Well, this feels like game, set and match to Nicolas Sarkozy.
Well, you were there as it happened and as it emerged hour by hour. Just talk us through briefly what actually happened, what formally has been agreed, and how the British position emerged. I mean, was that always expected? Did it emerge in the back and forth, the sort of haggling over the table? Yeah.
Well, what emerged was that Angela Merkel, who in a sense is the Chancellor of Germany, at the end of the day has got to sort of fund any problems with the Eurozone. Her view was that she wanted the Lisbon Treaty to be revised and therefore revised by all 27 members of the European Union, and that would then mean that the institutions of the European Union would be able to underpin the new tough fiscal rules for the Eurozone. That wasn't possible because essentially David Cameron demanded a protocol in the revised treaty that would essentially safeguard the UK position in the single market and protect the City of London. The French said, we are not going to have special treatment for the United Kingdom. You are effectively trying to get an opt-out from financial services regulations. So to coin a phrase from General de Gaulle, non, they said to Britain. And then the Germans had to accept that the consequence of that was that you would have an intergovernmental treaty negotiated amongst the 17 members of the Eurozone and anyone else who wants to join it. And the anyone else who wants to join it is 23, 24. It's moving up.
Last point on this may seem a slightly nerdy point, but you mentioned Maastricht before, and the solution there was an opt-out, just saying, OK, everyone else in Europe is bound by this, but Britain opts out. Why couldn't it have been like that this time?
Because what we were trying to get in the French view was special rules for the City of London and therefore special rules for the single market. And what they're saying is the single market, which essentially was a British creation, it was Lord Cofield who was the real brains and the push behind that. They're essentially saying the single market is a rules-based system in which these fantastically competitive economies manage to compete. And what you British are saying is that you want a special little opt-out, special rules for the area that affects you. Well, if you're going to have special rules for the city, perhaps the Germans might like special rules for car manufacturing. Perhaps the French might like special rules for agriculture. And they're essentially saying to the British, that is not consistent with the way that you believe the single market should be run, and it's not fair. So we're not going to let that happen.
All right, so the city was central to David Cameron's objections, Neil Spratley. First of all, some very voices on the left are saying, aha, so now we know David Cameron views the city's interest as synonymous with the national interest. Put that to one side for one moment. But was he right that the city really would have taken a huge hit if he had signed up and said yes to this?
Very hard to tell. I mean, what I find odd about this debate about financial regulation, it seems to have come down to the financial transaction tax, which has achieved this sort of totemic status within the debate. I mean, I don't think the financial transaction tax would have had that greater impact on London. Some people disagree. But what I find odd is that how the political fallout has sort of concentrated on this issue, when it's really not a sort of thing to fall out about. And the other point to make here is I think the idea that Britain wants just sort of lax regulation and that and we want freedom just to sort of chivvy away is actually not quite the truth. Because, I mean, if you think about some of the regulation coming out of Britain at the moment, like the Vickers report that's going to probably be adopted next week, there's no way on earth that Germany or France would adopt something as stringent as that, because Deutsche Bank and SocGen wouldn't allow it. They like their big universal banks. They're not in the business of breaking up banks. And you know, similarly, last night we had the estimate of the amount of new capital that's got to go into the banks. It's the German and the French banks that are undercapitalized, not the British ones, because we did that stuff a few years ago.
Can I just say something about the city there?
Sorry, Nick, what?
Can I say something about the city there? The real British concern was over regulation of financial services. And they are decided not with a veto. They're decided through qualified majority voting, which means that we can be outvoted. And that's where we were really, really concerned. And what is interesting is what David Cameron has actually done is he has actually sped up the process in which Britain will become a smaller and smaller minority. And it will find it more and more difficult to form what's called a blocking minority to block regulations that it doesn't like. Because by essentially taking itself out of the main picture, it becomes less of a key player, and member states that would be sympathetic to the UK will be thinking, well, actually, the top dogs are France and Germany. I think I'll make sure I align myself with them.
Well, let's put that to you, Martin Kettle. I mean, that idea that he is, Boris Johnson saying he's played a blinder, but actually, just listening to what Nick Wadd has said, David Cameron put himself into an isolated position in the corner of the room, is what Nick said, and will actually be not just removed, but cast as the scapegoat in Brussels, the guy who vetoed what was an important move to, in their view, save the euro.
Well, I think there's a lot in that, Johnny. I mean, the difficulty for Cameron, nevertheless, is that he is the leader of a party which doesn't want to be part of any of this to a large extent. Therefore, he's politically always having to look over his shoulder when he goes to Brussels. He's always having to look at his backbenches, at his colleagues, at Boris Johnson, who clearly covets the leadership of the party and is pretty unscrupulous about promoting himself on as a leadership candidate. And he has to balance all that with the pressures that he faces in Brussels. I think it's a tragic moment for Britain because I think, you know, if you're going to be in a club and in which you are isolated as one, effectively the one big player that isn't prepared to play, then you're rather like Carlos Tevez and Manchester City. You know, you're nominally on the books, but you're not willing to play and they don't want to play with you. So, you know, what do you do? And I think, these are chickens coming home to roost, because this is what the Tory party has been building towards for a very long time. It's what the press wants to a very large extent in this country. And we're going to have to live with it, very unfortunately, because that's the political reality.
Because
the big problem,
about
of course, is the coalition and where the Liberal Democrats stand in all this.
All right. Well, just before we get to that, I mean, this mention we heard before of a two-speed Europe that Nick Watt was talking about. I mean, you know, for some, that seems like a terrible threat. But actually, there'll be plenty of people, the newspapers on the Conservative benches, presumably, who think two-speed Europe's a great idea and are very happy being in that slow lane.
Yes, I mean, the trouble is they don't really want to be on the motorway. So, you know, they're looking, you know, to carry that metaphor forward, they're looking for the next exit. And so that problem has not been parked, I think. I think it's very live. And the Tory party will, I think, try to push forward on this now.
Nils, how would that play out economically? What would be the economic consequences? First of us just being isolated in the corner of the room, in the slow lane, you know, in the service station on the motorway, whichever way you want to put it. What are the consequences of that for the economy?
I think the answer to that depends entirely on whether the European project, whether the euro is saved via this deal. I mean, clearly, if the euro collapses or fragments in some way, you could argue quite rashly that Britain is best off far away from that disaster, and it's probably better to start swimming away now. Clearly, the political danger is that, you know, if they do manage to muddle through in 5-6 years' time, and they have a far more coherent, dynamic euro and eurozone, then we would be isolated. But at the moment, it's very hard to know which bet you would want to make. And I'd sort of ask Martin, do you think a Labour government would have acted differently from Cameron yesterday?
Well, I think the answer to that is the short answer is probably not. But I don't think it would have been where Cameron is. I think it would have certainly one under Blair, I think, would have tried to be closer to the action and tried to keep a foot in both camps. Probably one under Brown, or one in which Ed Balls was calling the shots, would have been pretty close to where Cameron was. But even so, I mean, there's still a huge desire to be part of the European project in the Labour Party. And I think you heard from Douglas Alexander on the radio this morning how that remains the case.
Nick, since you're there, what has been the reaction to this British position? We're, of course, obsessing about that. But are people there, the other leaders, other heads of government, are they furious at the British, or are they shrugging their shoulders?
Well, Nicolas Sarkozy, when he walked into his press conference in the early hours of this morning, did a very slow sort of march up to the platform, and he was looking very serious. He was avoiding triumphalism, but of course he is absolutely delighted because this is almost institutionalizing what has always been the French goal, which is a two-speed Europe in which Britain is in the slow lane. And to pick up Martin's analogy, you know, heading off to the Little Chef, which was of course John Major's favorite place, to go and have a meal. So the French are pretty pleased. The Germans are disappointed. They're disappointed because Angela Merkel wanted to have a revision of the Lisbon Treaty at 27 for those reasons about needing the institutions to underpin the new rules for the Eurozone. But there's something much deeper reason for Angela Merkel's disappointment, which is that Germany really does want Britain to be a key player in the European Union, because they just believe that Britain is an important balancing act, because if the French had their way, everything would be pretty protectionist. The Germans are not a sort of free market as the UK is, but they certainly believe that Britain is performs quite an important balancing act. The European Commission, José Manuel Barroso, I think he's really disappointed, and he thinks, don't forget, Barroso is a bit of an Anglophile. He reads The Spectator. He thinks that David Cameron is playing a pretty dangerous game and putting Britain either in the slow lane, in the little shed, or in the corner of the room.
Well, you know, easy for us to say from our perch. Well, let's go round once. What should he have done? What is the deal Cameron should have pushed for, whether or not it was realistic? Let's start with you, Martin Kettle.
Well, I don't think he should have stood up for the city in the way that he did. I think the historic thing that the government has to do is to break the lock which the city exerts over all British economic and foreign policy. And I'm afraid that, you know, we've got to look them in the eye, and Cameron won't do that.
Neil Spratley, what should he have done?
Yeah, I think, as Martin was saying in his previous answer, I think building alliances beforehand, before he went into these negotiations, would have been a much smarter move, more likely to stay in the room.
And Nick, was there any way he could have signed up for a deal that was binding of all 27 and simultaneously have kept his coalition and his Conservative backbenchers happy?
Well, he may have been able to do it if he could have obviously got the protections he wanted for the city. But you do that by ensuring, as Martin was saying, that you have much better relations beforehand. And what he should have done was not allow George Osborne to insult the French a few weeks ago when he said that France was heading in the direction of Italy. And I think he severely misjudged Angela Merkel. And that, of course, goes back to the decision of David Cameron many years ago to withdraw the Conservatives from the main centre-right grouping in the European Parliament, something which absolutely horrified Angela Merkel.
But you think there was a compromise here to be hacked out if only the groundwork had been there in advance?
I don't think there was a compromise to be worked out by the time David Cameron pitched up in Brussels yesterday. But I think that if the mood music had been different, if he'd been engaged with the French and the Germans, if George Osborne had not insulted the French, then maybe the mood music was different. I mean, it's interesting that before the summit started yesterday, there was a meeting of all the main centre-right groupings in Marseille. David Cameron would have been there if he hadn't pulled the Tories out of the EPP. He wasn't. He wasn't there for those informal discussions. And who are his main allies in Europe? Which grouping could he have been meeting? Well, that's the main opposition party in Poland. That is where he thinks Britain should be exerting its influence. And if that's your approach, then this is probably where you're going to end up.
You made fleeting mention, Martin, of the fact that he is in coalition. I cut you off, but this is an extraordinary turnaround where the Lib Dems, the Liberal Democrats in Britain, previously always known as the most Europhile of any British political party, are in a government that has made this radical move that some are calling a kind of wrecking ball aimed at the heart of the European Union. How do they live with this?
I think the only way that they can console themselves is if they absolutely now draw the line. If the government as a whole, including the Tory party and all Tory ministers, draw the line against any form of further referendum on Europe, I think that's the only thing that gives Clegg any credibility on this question.
Except the Tory backbenchers may have their tail up and want an in or out referendum and
certainly
feel that the momentum is with them. Listen, as we record, it is still going on. The European EU leaders are desperately working at this hour to try and salvage something from this summit. So last closing thought from all of you, what happens now? Nick Watt, you're there.
Well, I mean, the big thing they've decided today was to sign the accession treaty for Croatia. The European Union is now 27. It's soon going to go up to 28. And yes, we're quite right to be talking about, obviously, what a significant moment this is for Britain. But let's just think of this. Croatia, one of the two largest republics in Yugoslavia. Britain's greatest failure since the Second World War was to allow Yugoslavia to disintegrate into civil war. Croatia is going to be joining, but obviously it's looking much more difficult for Serbia. That, in a way, is historically something really important that we shouldn't forget about.
Nils Pradley?
Well, without wanting to just dispute for a moment the historical implications, I mean, there is the quite narrow point that sooner or later, Italy and Spain have to be financed to get through this crisis. And at the moment, prices in the market suggest it can't be done at attractive rates. And that puzzle still seems to be unsolved.
So actually, this whole point of this meeting was to save the euro. We may be all back again in a matter of weeks or even before Christmas to try and save the euro again.
I think there will be another make or break summit on the saving the euro.
And Martin Kettle, people thinking this may be the beginning of the end of Britain's involvement with the European Union, that this could be the day that the exit began, even if it takes years to come good or to materialise. Is that an exaggeration? What do you think happens next?
Well, I think that it is a bit of an exaggeration. I mean, I think David Cameron's in the same, he's speaking the same language as the 18th century Prime Minister Robert Walpole, who famously said to the Queen at the time that, Madam, there are 30,000 people killed in Europe this year and not one Englishman. But Walpole, nevertheless, in spite of his isolationism, was always involved in European diplomacy. And Britain, in fact, was always involved in European wars after his death. So, you know, plus ça change, plus c'est la même chose.
Nice European flavour to close out the programme, which has taken us from Robert Walpole via the Little Chef to the heart of Britain's European dilemma. My thanks to our panel, Martin Kettle, Nick Watt in Brussels, and here in the studio, Neil Spratley. We'll have more on this story all the way through the day as it unfolds on guardian.co.uk. /politics. I'm Jonathan Friedland. The producer was Phil Maynard. Thanks for listening.
Nova is America's most watched science series. You'll find it every night at 7:50 on PBS, Sky Channel 166, Virgin Media 243. PBS, where television matters.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.